Okay, we begin here on the top of Ayinan, but Aleph, three lines down. Amar Rav Anan, Amar Shmuel, Ma'ot Shoyitomim, Mutar La'avotam Biribit. When you have monies of the orphans, where we need to make money for them, we need to do something for them, it's permissible to lend them out and to garner interest on the money. Amar Rav Nachman, Mishum Diatmeninhu, Sfina Lahu Isura? How could it be? Just because of Yitomim, we're going to feed them Isur? So Yatme d'achle d'lav didhu lizdu batar shavkayu. So Nachman says, and Yitomim who eat that which doesn't belong to them, they should follow those that brought them about. I mean their father, who had already passed away and gone to the Olam HaMet, that they should follow behind him and go in his way if they're taking that which does not belong to them. Samalei emali ezo gufad uvda hechava. So he sees that this must have come about from some sort of incident that he witnessed. So Rav Nachman says to him, why don't you tell me what exactly you witnessed so that we can figure out what it was. There was this urn that belonged to the children of Mar Ukva. And again, of course, they are Yitomim at this point. Mar Ukva has passed away. Davabei Mar Shmuel. That was kept in the house of Shmuel. So Shmuel was the executor, was taking care of these Yitomim, at least financially. So, Tokil v'yohivle, Tokil v'shakile. They used to weigh it, and then give it out to be rented. And then they used to weigh it, and take it back, after they had rented it out. Shakil agra, v'shakil pachto. They took not only the rental income, they also collected the diminution in value, the weight differential between when they lent it out, and the time that they took it back. So, I agra lo pachta, vi pachta lo agra. So he's making the point, this comes off of the previous sugya where they were speaking about the boat. And then when it comes to the boat, the Gemara had said there that there was agra upagra, that you're allowed to both take rental income from the boat, as well as demand that the person who's renting the boat take out called disaster insurance, that he pay for it if the boat is not returned. As far as the boat's value going up and down, that's not the problem of the person who rented it. The depreciation from the usage of the boat, that's also not the problem of the person who rented it. Only thing that the Gemara permitted was a case where he rents it and he's on the hook if he destroys the boat or he doesn't bring the boat back. So those are allowed. Over here, it seems that they're actually taking more than that. They're not just taking responsibility after they rent it for if the urn gets destroyed, or if the urn's no longer there, they're actually taking responsibility for the change in value in the urn. That's way too much responsibility on the renter. If he's already paying you for the rent, that's exactly what the rent goes for. The rent is for the depreciation and the usage of the item. The fact that you're charging him more on top of that makes it look like it is ribit. As long as the original owner has some risk left, then it's not considered to be a loan or interest. So what risk has to be left? So far, it seemed to be, from yesterday's daf, the risk that had to be left was, it's called yukra v'zola, which is the market appreciation or depreciation, and he takes the risk of the change in the value, plus you have to take the risk of the depreciation. Those were the things that we required the owner of the item to take in order for it not to be deemed a loan and interest at the same time. Because if he is guaranteed not to lose his product, and on top of that, you're paying rent, then basically what you're doing is you're borrowing the product and paying interest on the item because you are fully responsible for the item. That means you have to return to him the exact amount that he's giving you. And then on top of that, you're paying an additional fee above and beyond the fact that you have to return him the exact item. You can't have both of those be true. It can't be that you're demanding that he pay you back exactly what it's given. That's she'elah. That's borrowing. If you want it to be schira rental, then the rental income has to come in exchange for something. So yes, it's the utility, the usage of the item, but the usage of the item includes depreciation and also does not include the responsibility for the market fluctuations in price. If you've accepted all that responsibility, you now have debt instead of equity. If that's the case, then either you're lending it to him and he should be collecting anything, or you're asking him to make a full repayment or a cash payment for whatever he got, plus the rental income against it into interest. And that's what's happening here. Here, they're not only charging them the fee for the usage of the urn, they're also charging them for the depreciation, the usage. Then you're double dipping in a sense, but That double dipping really leads to a problem of interest because you're guaranteeing the value plus you are now paying a fee on top of that. The meivad then is even permissible with those that are older. Diknani means zakan or zakain, whether it means someone who's older or someone has a beard, but it means even yitomim gidolim could do that. Because they are accepting the responsibility for the diminution of copper. Because the more that it is heated up, there is a loss of copper that is there. So the explanation here is that when you rent the dud, when you rent the urn, you have a right to use the urn. You have a right to use it the way that it's normally used. But what happens with the urn is that not only is there usage, but your heating up of the urn does something to the copper, which ruins the copper that's there or the remaining copper that's there. So what they're charging you for is the change in the weight. You can see that the weight change in the copper to charge you for the disappearance or the usage of the copper that is going through. They're not demanding that you pay them the market change in the price of copper. They simply want the price for the copper that is now used. So Rashi explains over here, Afal pi shemishalim et hachoser mishkal, yesh pachat binechoshet hanotar ba. Even though they're paying for the disappearance of the copper that's there, and what you're saying is, isn't that a part of the usage? I mean, that is embedded in the fact that when you use the urn, it's going to go down in weight, and that it's going to change the properties of the urn that you're using. But he says, nevertheless, yesh pchat b'nechoshe notarbo hanisraf ba'or. Chol nechoshe saruf damav pchutim. So he says there are two aspects of depreciation which they're trying to capture. And each one of the payments captures a different part of the depreciation or utility here. One is the fact that every time you use the urn, that the copper, some copper disappears. But beyond that, the remaining copper, after it's been heated up, also has a depreciation or it's lost some of its integrity or value. And so you need to pay for that as well. So there's two streams of depreciation and they're trying to capture both of them. Both the disappearance of the copper as well as the diminution in value of the remaining copper. The rental payment only captures the one aspect. That's how they dealt with the issue of these two pieces of depreciation. Technically, they could have charged it all in the rental aspect, but this was a way to get an exact measurement of the change of the copper weight. So they dealt with one of them in an exact manner. The rent captured the other depreciation stream. What's being clarified here is that as long as they're not accepting the market fluctuations and guaranteeing that the value of the urn when it left is the same value when they get it back, that they're not guaranteeing, then it's not a loan. They can be charged for the depreciation of the usage. They cannot be charged for the fact that I handed to you as worth 30. When you give it back to me, it's got to be worth 30. Once you do that, then you're guaranteeing the value. Then it becomes like a loan. And then any fee that you're collecting is rebate. So the fact that you're not guaranteeing the value, but just paying for the usage or the depreciation, the change in the object itself, that's what we call the pchat of the object, that is allowed. And over here, there were two streams of pchat that they were dealing with. So what Rav Nachman says to Rav Anan, you concluded the wrong thing from what you saw. You concluded from what you saw that Yitomim are allowed to charge interest. That's what he saw. He saw them both paying for the rental income plus paying for the change in the weight of the item. He surmised that that meant you're allowed to charge interest for Yitomim. Rav Nachman says you read the situation incorrectly because both of these are considered to be proper forms of payment for the utility that you get from the urn itself. And that's what the Gemara says here. Because Taha mekabli alayu chuska dinechasha, tekama de mikle nechasha botzir damea. Because they are accepting the diminution, the value of the copper, because the more that the copper is used, the worse it is or its value deteriorates. And so you're not paying for the market change in the copper, you're paying for the fact that the usage actually takes the price or the value of the copper down. And that's part of the rental income. Again, they split the two streams up. If they had combined them, it would have been the same thing. They just did this in a way where they captured both forms of depreciation separately. So now, the Bali of Tosafot over here say that mashma afagav dekabel notein alei zola biyokra, Sounds familiar that even if the grantor of the item of the capital have asur mishum d'achrayut al mikabel, that it would have been problematic had the responsibilities all been on the mikabel. Even if the market variations remained with the original grantor of the capital, the lender of the item, the renter of the item, then that would not have been sufficient because of the fact that the mikabel, the recipient, is taking on all the other responsibilities. But he says, wait a minute, didn't we just yesterday have that exactly with the case of the Sfina? By the Sfina, you have agropagra, and why is it that that's allowed? Mishum de kabalei kilkula Sfina shmit kakel ha'etz b'mayim. The reason that that is okay is because the original owner of the boat, the grantor of the capital or the item here, takes responsibility for the deterioration of the wood in the water, which is why he's getting the rental income. So meaning that he is still responsible for that deterioration in the item. He says, Mikan kasha the perish rivan. And this is a problem from the explanation of the rivan. She perish leel, she muta liten iska la machasit schar, karov le schar v'rachok tefseid. You're allowed to go into a business transaction in which the person gives in capital, and in giving in capital for half the value, even though it's very likely you'll make money and very unlikely that you will lose, as long as the person gives in capital, gives yokra bezola, gives the market fluctuations. Which is also the sheet of Rashi. You can see that on the bottom of Samach Ted Amud Bet. The Rashi says, Alma kol kama de lo kabila le zola, lav milvehi gabe. Vigabi svina nami lo kabila le zola. Rashi just requires the fact that the grantor of the capital or the item here that is being utilized, as long as they accept the market variations in the price, that's sufficient to deem it not to be a milveh. And Rashi is clear that he does not require any acceptance of the depreciation by the grantor of the capital or of the item in order for it to be deemed not a loan. And Tosafot here, as well as many of the Rishonim, as well as the Shulchan Aruch and his Psak, disagree with Rashi based on our sugi over here, because
Dim Kain, Lama Yetzirich Kan Lekabel Chuska Nechosha, Lo Yikabel El Zola.
If that was right, then why do you have to accept over here the deterioration of the nechoshet? You should only have to accept on yourself the diminution in value of the market price. And therefore, he is unwilling to accept this position of the rivan. Market variations in the price or the value of the object is not sufficient risk to make it that it's not a loan anymore. You need more than that. You need more responsibility or more acceptance of responsibility than simply market fluctuations. So you have to accept deterioration or some sort of depreciation on the item, and that is why you're getting the rental income. If you're guaranteed everything besides the market variation of the price, that's still problematic, Balei HaTosafot say, against what the Rivan had suggested before. Now the Gemara continues here and says, Amar Rabba bar Shila Amar Rav Chistav, Amar Ila Amar Rabba bar Yosef bar Chama Rav Sheshet, Ma'ot sheyitomim mutar la'avotam karov l'schar rachok lehefseid. So now we're taking another step, which is, fine, you can't charge interest for the property of the yitomim, but we will let them do is lend out money, enter into business transactions in which their high likelihood is that they will profit, and there's a low likelihood of loss. Over here, in the past, we have said that is problematic because it's not ribit mamash, it's not ribit tzutza, it's not real interest payment, but it is avak ribit. Because over here, when you structure the transaction in a way that you'll very unlikely lose, and then on top of that, you're getting benefit from that, that means in essence, you have a loan or an effective loan outstanding. You don't have equity investment, you have a debt that you're going to get back, your principal amount. In addition to the principal amount, you're garnering some sort of benefit or profit here. That looks like, or is, in an essence, a rebeat. And that's what the Chazal called a vak rebeat. Because if you get back too much of the principal, or are almost guaranteed the principal, plus the payments, that looks like a rebeat. So what they're saying here is, because a vak rebeat is midrabanan, Rashi says, ubiyatme lo gozor. By yitamim, they were not gozer. So now, when we're dealing with ribit do raita, that we're not going to play around with, that we're not going to do for the yitomim. But when we're talking about ribit de rabbanan, there we're willing to bend a little bit to help out the yitomim. Because we're in a bind. You have an escrow. You have a certain amount of a fund that is left to take care of the Yatomim. The only thing that's going to happen now is that that fund is going to be drawn on to pay for the Yatomim. But that means it's going to deteriorate over time. So now, what you want to do is somehow create a situation in which you can earn money for them, earn returns, so that we can use that pool of money to sustain them for a longer period of time. The problem is, who gives you the right to play around with the Yatomim's money? Who gives you the right to lose the Yatomim's money? So what we want to do is structure a transaction in which we are basically guaranteed a return on the money of the Yatomim, and that way we can both provide for the Yatomim, but also not be in violation of the Isur of Ribit. So the way that we do that is we take certain structures that are Asur Midrabanan, and we say that the Rabbanan waived the restrictions for the Yatomim in order to help them in these situations. It's the same problem that you have with a scholarship fund. The scholarship fund, if you do nothing, will simply dwindle over time. So what you want to do with the scholarship fund is earn money on the scholarship fund so that you can provide more scholarships over time. But the problem is that you don't want to risk the principal amount, because otherwise you'll be giving out less scholarships. So they want to do the same thing here, which is how do we preserve the principal amount, but then be able to take care of the Yatomim for a longer period of time. This is the mechanism that they recommend. So now, Tana Banan, Karov L'Schar, V'Rachok L'Hefseid Rasha. Someone who enters into a business transaction in which their structure is that they are likely to be rewarded, and there's a very low likelihood that they will lose, Rasha. That is basically what we've been calling until now a Vak Ribit, or effective interest, because it's simulating a loan, even though it's not technically a loan, because of the protections that you have to get your principal amount back. Karov L'Hefseid V'Rachok L'Schar Chasid. So this is an interesting line in the Gemara, which is, if the structure is that you most likely will lose, and maybe in a chances you will make money, that's called a chassid. Now, I'm not sure why you have to lose money to be called a chassid, so that's a difficult statement of the Gemara, but I think what the Gemara is trying to imply here is that this person is careful not to violate the restriction or the laws of interest. And so that he's a chassid, not because he's losing money, he's a chassid because he's so careful not to enter into agreements that would bring him to interest or close to problems of interest. I don't think that there's any compliment for you going out and losing money, but there is a necessity to be careful that when you do invest or you enter into business transactions, that they're done properly. And that means even if the structure leaves you in a worse position, that is okay because you're preventing yourself from violating the Isur HaTorah. Karov lezeh ulezeh urachok mizeh umizeh. If it's just as likely the loss of the prophet, or as unlikely the loss of the prophet, zoi midat kol adam, that's a regular person, that's the regular interactions that people have, which is when you enter into a transaction, you have risks that you undertake, there are benefits that you could get, and that's called investing. You take the chances and the responsibilities of what's happening, and that's a normal way to engage in business practices. Amalei Rav Rav Yosef, Hanei Zuzei Diyatme, Heicha Abdin Luhu. So here, Rabba speaks to Rav Yosef and says, and basically is asking the question that we formulated or articulated before, which is, what do we do with the money of the Yatomim? The Beit Din, we've said before, becomes Avihem Shel Yatomim. They're the ones responsible for the Yatomim. And so these individuals, these Tamarei Chachamim, are the heads of the Batei Dinim, are really faced with this challenge of how to deal with the Yatomim's money. Over here, Amalei, Motvina Lohu Beit Dina, Be'avina Lohu Zuza Zuza. Yosef says, you sit down a Beit Din, basically you make the Beit Din the executors of the estate, and then you provide it to them on a basis. You don't hand the Yatomim all the money. You give it out to them on a need-by-need basis, and therefore you preserve the whatever is there. It doesn't go to waste. Samalei, v'akakal yakarno. This is exactly what we spoke about. That's limited to the principal amount that is there. Once you have run through the principal amount, there's nothing left to give the Yatomim. So you've only got whatever money you've been given, or that's in escrow for them. Other than that, you're not helping them to extend or grow the pool of money into which they can dip. So Amalei Mar, Heichi Ovid. He says, what do you do? You know, Rav Yosef says, back to Rabba, what do you do? Amalei Badkin and Gavra, Dile Dahava Pricha. We try to find a guy who has gold that is, Rashi says, Grupta Ochel Zahav. Whether that means some sort of chips of gold or wrong gold. It's not a gold bar or something that normally would be a way to carry or store value in gold. He has just flakes, chips, or raw gold. The reason for this is because then we know for sure it is his. The risk with gold is that it might be his, or someone might have deposited the gold with him. So we don't know really if he's wealthy because it's his gold, or does he look wealthy because someone else deposited and he's in keeping in safekeeping for someone else. So what we do is we look for items that indicate wealth, but are also things that other people would not deposit with him. So this type of gold, which is not in a form that is stored value, again, like a brick of gold, or a way that you would transfer the gold to someone else, then if this person has it in their possession, then it's clear it's theirs and nobody else. Nobody gives you gold flakes or gold dust to watch for them, because that's not something that is the way that people normally keep gold. So it must be his. So it has to be something where it's obvious that he has wealth, but it's wealth that we can be sure is his, and not just because someone else deposited the item with him. Now, tinin dava mine, and what we do is we take some of the gold from him, and then we give him the money of the atomim in a structure which is karov l'schar rachok tefseid, which is what we described before, where there might be an iser avak ribit midrabanan. So we structure it in that way. Aval, davar misuyam lo. But if it is an object, which is a discrete object, it's not simply gold, it's a gold object. But that means gold coins. That means a gold utensil, gold vessel, gold brick. That you don't do. Dilma pikadon ninu. Because maybe it was a deposit with him. Va'ate mare. And the owner's gonna come. Ya'iv simanim v'shokile. He's gonna give the simanim and walk off with it. And then we have no collateral, we have no way to protect the money of the yatomim. So now, what they're doing here is they're going to wealthier individuals who could basically backstop the money of the yatomim. So when we hand it over to this individual to invest on their behalf, and we structure it in a way where it's very unlikely that they will lose, very likely that they will gain, that's great as long as you have recourse against the individual. Karov, l'schar, and rachok me'afseid means that the person who's taking responsibility for the money has a way to make up the losses if there are losses. So you want to go to someone who's wealthy enough that they can backstop the monies of the yatomim that you've given to them. If there are losses, you'll demand them to pay the losses. And we take collateral for that to ensure there aren't losses. So we take advantage of these wealthy individuals by having them backstop the money of the yatomim and then invest it in a way in which they will get good monies back. And that the court invests with these wealthy individuals with a eye to having it strongly result in a good return, and have them backstop it because they're wealthy individuals. And in that way, we can earn money for the yatomim, but we also know that we're not going to lose the principal amount because we are going after wealthy individuals who can ensure that the principal amount remains intact. That's how we take care of the yatomim. There is a large Tosfot over here who says, not exactly sure how it is that when the guy shows up with the siman, he's able to walk away with the gold utensil over here. Tosfot says, why can't the person who's holding the utensil just say, lakuach ubiyadi, I bought it. Even if someone else can give a siman about an item, if the individual says, I bought it, then the siman doesn't mean anything. What right does he have to show up with the siman and then just walk away with the item? So Tosfot then moves on to suggest maybe it's after the individual passes away. And then you're coming to the yatomim and giving a siman. And here we don't have any information about it was lakua chubiyadi. And they don't know that. And Beit Din won't be toying that on his behalf. The Tosafot speaks about why that would be. And therefore there is a chance that the person will come and take it with simanim. But then he talks about an interesting dilemma. He says, Miu, Kasha, Kevin Damidhu, since this guy is wealthy, Amai lo niton liyatme lakuachu, why don't we just say that it was bought? We only use, say, the possibility that they bought it when we saw the father using it in his lifetime. If he didn't use it during his lifetime, and now we have this item and someone's showing up with the simanim, it makes, or there's circumstantial evidence that this was a pikadon. And therefore we would give it back with the siman. Aval, here's the dilemma. You don't leave anybody who's a child of a wealthy individual any chance. Shadam shaya ragil etzlam. Anybody who visited their house on a regular basis, yodea inyanam, and has some sense of what goes on in the house, He'll give tell other people, because he is suspect, because he went in and out of the house. So when he comes with simanim, we're not going to believe him, because we know he was there. All he does is he'll feed the information to other people. Simanei kesef zahav shalem, the simanim of all the gold and the silver that sits in the break front, which they never use. And then they're going to show up and give the simanim and walk off with it, and we won't be toein lakuachu. So he says that's really problematic. We're setting up a structure in which the children of the wealthy will have no protection against people show up and saying that it was a deposit with them. So if that's the case, why do you need also that the gold be this flakes of gold or this broken gold and not a discrete object? Just say in front of Beit Din, it's his. The problem is not that the guy will show up and give a siman. We're afraid that a dim will show up and say that this individual put the object here and it has this siman. So we're not afraid of the guy showing up and giving a siman, because against that we have a protection which says, I bought it from you and we're not going to hand it over. The problem we have is if two edim show up and say, so-and-so deposited this item with him, and here are the simanim, and then it walks away. Then you've lost your collateral. You've lost your ability to protect the yitomim. So the Tosfot just creates a situation or a circumstance in which there would be that risk, but he has to identify what is the circumstance in which this risk would exist. And in doing so, he goes through, again, the different iterations, but in those iterations, he shows you that there are problems. If we don't take care of these issues, then you're going to end up situations in which people could take advantage of the yitomim or the children of Ashirim, and so we have to give or put in the proper protection so that they're not losing money just because their father passed away and they happen to be wealthy. Alright, so now the Gemara says, so Amar Rav Ashi, Tinach imishtakach gavra ditle dava pricha. That works well if you can find these individuals who are walking around with these broken pieces of gold or have this gold in hand so we know they're wealthy. Then in the situation where we don't find these wealthy individuals to backstop it, once again, you're going to eat into the principal amount of the yitomim, and there's not going to be sufficient means to support them. We look for an individual who is property or assets are quiet. Rashi says, oh, mashafu. Rashi Zevir, Shinachasav Shketim Eitzlo. Things are quiet. There's no claims against him. There aren't people questioning his ownership. He's not in altercations with individuals over the ownership of items. He's got a clean hold on his assets. Umehemin. And he also is a trustworthy individual. Vishama Dina De'oraito. And he follows the Torah laws. Velo Mikabel Shamto De'rabonon. And he's not subject to nidoi, meaning that he is not involved in situations or circumstances that demand that he be put into nidoi. And then we give him the money before the beitin, because beitin has a right or the power or authority to be mafkir his nechasim in order to ensure that the yitomim get their money back. And so we do it under the auspices of beitin, because then they have the power to make sure that the yitomim get their money back. But we're looking for, in the end, trustworthy, upstanding individuals who can then invest on behalf of the Yitomim. Or basically, we're going to give them the money with some sort of almost guaranteed return, not ribit tzutza midoraita, but at least ribit midorabanan. And we're going to give it back to the Yitomim in order that they will garner enough money to live off whatever has been left for them, the principal amount that is put into escrow for them. Interestingly enough, we are allowing, in this sense, the violation of an Isur D'Rabbanan. So that makes sense because the Rabbanan goes there and they can waive their Gzeirah or Takana in places where it's to the benefit of society, like in this instance with the Yitomim. The fact that the Gemara had a Havamina that maybe even by Isurim D'Oraita is even more interesting. You could argue from another standpoint, either that the Yitomim are K'tanim and they're not Chayav in Mitzvot, so therefore we are working on their behalf, and we're allowed to do it for them because they're Akhtanim, even though that seems difficult, but at least we will, and that's Rav Nachman's retort here, where we're going to feed them Isura just because they are Akhtanim. And even in that situation, the Balei Tosfot point out that there's a difficulty because the Isurim of Ribit, we're going to see in the end of the Perek, apply not only to the lender, they also apply to the borrower. So even if we can exempt the lenders from the problem of ribit, which is the yitomim, it doesn't mean that the borrower who's paying the interest is still not subject to the isur of paying interest to someone who's lending him with interest. And so Tosfot says the Gemara could have asked that question. It had a better question in the end. But technically, the problem is on both sides. And therefore, if you have ribit midoraita, you have a serious issue also for the borrower of the money, not just the lender of the money. Ela im kein, you take the position that when there is no problem of interest on the lender side, there's also no problem of interest on the borrower side. Meaning that the borrower's position that he's chayav for the violation of interest is a chiddush. The fact that the borrower, who is not the one who's the beneficiary, but actually the one who's losing, the fact that the Torah says he is restricted and is violating a lav, that's a chidush. So now if you're in a circumstance or a situation in which the lender is not subject to the restriction of interest, we might say there that the borrower also is not subject to the restriction because it was already a chiddush that he was even subject to the restriction at all. So that could get you over the problem that the Balei HaTosafot raised. But again, it's just interesting in general, this approach here of the Gemara for the benefit of the Yitomim. And they're looking or searching for ways to protect the Yitomim, that they're willing to waive these Isurim Derabanan and for the protection of those that are in the difficult circumstances or in situations in which they need or desperately need to take care of these Yitomim. And that might have nafkaminot alocha, which are brought down in other places, that where a person is in a difficult situation or dire straits, are they allowed to then enter into transactions or situations in which they violate avak ribit or a ribit derabanan? And so from this, it might indicate that there might be some room for maneuverability where a person is found in dire straits to allow them to benefit from avak ribit min derabanan, even though the chatchila or in general we would not permit such a thing. All right, next Mishnah. Ein mikablin tzona barzel miYisrael mipnei shehu ribit, because it is ribit. So you're not allowed to accept. We just saw this Gemara earlier that you're not allowed to accept from a Yisrael tzona barzel. Tzona barzel, Rashi explained in yesterday's daf. Barzel is there like iron because there are ironclad that you're going to get back your principal amount. And so the problem of tzona barzel is basically the recipient of the capital, the recipient of the item, is guaranteeing everything. He's backstopping everything. And then there could be profits. So now that's the equivalent of a debt or a loan with the possibility of the upside, which would be then interest, and that is ribit. So Jews are not allowed to enter into such structures because they are deemed to be ribit. They're a problem of interest. Now it's called Sona Barzel. The Barzel part is the fact that it's ironclad or protective of the one who's investing the capital. And Rashi says the tzon part is because, in all likelihood, tzon were the major way in which this was done. This transaction was structured around tzon, around herds of animals, in which you accepted the value of the herds of the animal up front, and basically guaranteed back the value of that herd. Plus, if they gave birth, if they grew and they were able to sell them for more, then there was schar, there was rewards, there was upside to that. And that's the way these things were structured, and that's why they're called tzon or barzel. That is problematic for a Yisrael to enter into. Rashi says this Mishnah is completely unnecessary because we just had a Mishnah about the Chanut. And by the Chanut, we said that a person is not allowed to invest on a joint basis, on a 50-50 basis, where one person is providing the capital, the other person is providing the services, and the person providing the services gets 50% of the return, and the person investing the capital gets 50% of the return. We said over there that's problematic because 50% of the capital that's given in is an equity investment. That's the return for the person who's making the capital investment. 50% of it is a loan to the party who's providing the services in order for him to garner his 50% of returns. But that means that there's a loan there. For that loan, the provider of services is then working to produce returns on both parts of it, both on the picadon side as well as on the debt side. His working for free to make the returns is in essence deemed interest on the loan half of that structure. That's the structure that we've been speaking about all the way along for the last two or three daf, which is this palga l'schar, palga l'hefseid, that you get half of the upside, you get half of the downside, where one person is providing the capital and the other one's providing the services. From there, the Gemara says that if you guarantee half of the capital investment back. And it's a loan, that's problematic. Certainly over here where you guarantee 100% of the cap will be returned, that's certainly a problem of repeat. So Rashi says it's completely unnecessary. So why is it here? For the next line, which is, Aval mekablim tzona barzel mina akum. But you are allowed to enter into such transactions with a non-Jew. So Rashi says this part of the Mishnah is what is necessary, which is to tell us about the permissibility of doing this with a akum. Tosafot over here quotes Rashi and indicates that Rashi says that the repeat that is envisioned in the Tzona Barzel of our Mishnah is a repeat midrabanan, because he compares it to the case before of the chanut, or the situation or the structure in which one person provides the capital and the other one provides the services, and then they split the profits. The fact that Rashi compares it to that case shows you that it's a din derabanan, because that restriction is a bak repeat derabanan. The Balei Tosafot explain how it's possible that a din derabanan could then be a mafkia ownership enough to make you patur min habechora. So he gives an explanation for that, but then in the end leans heavily towards the sheet of the Rabbeinu Tam. V'nira kamosha perish Rabbeinu Tam, tamit nita nahochi ayri v'ribit d'oraita. The Mishnah here is speaking about ribit min haTorah, shepasak tamim alatzon. He guaranteed the value of the animals that were given to him, v'gam pasak tamei shevach. And then he also guaranteed a payment, a fixed payment per year, v'kibel alav latet v'chol shana gavar katsuv, ben yesham shevach, ben lo yeh. To pay that fixed payment year after year, whether or not there were profits or returns that were there. V'hainu ribit k'tzutza. And that is ribit d'oraita. And he says that the Rabbeinu Tam's explanation fits with the Yerushalmi. It seems the Yerushalmi explains it the same way. But here we have a din d'oraita. And therefore, now you can explain the two Mishnayot. This Mishnah is talking about the din d'oraita. The Mishnah before about the chenvani was talking about avak ribit or din d'ribit d'rabanan. So there's no duplication anymore, like Rashi suggested, where it's obvious from the previous Mishnah that this Mishnah is true. Because our Mishnah is talking about the din d'oraita. And again, the important part is that you're allowed to, min haTorah, lend to the Nachri with interest. The restriction is only a restriction d'rabanan. But our Mishnah is telling us, no ribit d'oraita, but yes ribit d'oraita to a Nachri. The other Mishnah of Chenvani is talking about a ribit d'rabanan. And in that way, you can explain why this Mishnah is necessary, unlike Rashi, who sees this as being a duplication or an obvious outgrowth of the Mishnah before by Chenvani. V'lavim mehen u'malvin otan b'ribit. You can borrow from them and lend to them with interest. By the way, that's what the Pasuk says. We're going to see that the Gemara thinks that maybe that's not what the Pasuk says. But the Pasuk says with regards to interest, lo tashich l'achicha, you may not charge interest or pay interest to your friend. Neshek kesef, neshek ocha, neshek kol davar sheyishach. L'nachri tashich, l'achicha, lo tashich. You do pay interest to the Nachri, you don't pay interest to your brother. I mean that the Pasuk contrasts the relationship you have with the Jew, where it's impermissible to have an interest-bearing loan, versus the Nachri, where l'nachri tashich. The Rambam reads it even as a mitzvah taseh, that it is a positive commandment in the Torah, l'nachri tashich, lend to the Nachri with interest. So the Rambam, who is unique in this, most of the Yishonim don't agree, but the Rambam sees this as a mitzvah taseh, to lend to the Nachri with interest. Balei Tosafot over here suggests that it's a necessity, not a mitzvah. It's a necessity because the Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells us, lo tichanein, that you're not allowed to give them for things for free. Instead, you're not allowed to give them things for free. If you lent them in the same way that you lent to Israel, then you'd be providing them a service or a benefit for free, which they're not necessarily entitled to because they're not part of the club. And since they're not part of the club, they shouldn't be able to garner that benefit. And there's a restriction of lo tichanein. So Tosafot says the necessity to charge interest is to avoid the iser of lo tichanein, of providing them something for free. So that's more of the mainstream view over here, that the nachri tashich is, first of all, either it's optional, that you're allowed to do it, it's permissible to do it, but now that's a mitzvah to do it, or, the way the Balei Tosafot would say, it's to avoid another iser of lo tichanein, but not, like the Rambam suggests over here, that there is a mitzvah. But meantime, what the Mishnah is saying is that interactions with the goy that involve interest are totally fine, and the same is true of a ger toshav, that's someone who has accepted, let's call it roughly, the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, doesn't want to worship Avodah Zarah, but he's still a nachri, he's not a Jew, and therefore interactions with him with regards to interest are totally fine. Malvei Yisrael ma'otav shel akum midat akum, Avalo midat Yisrael. A Jew can lend out the monies of an akum. He can be an emissary or a shliach of the akum to lend it out with interest. But the dat akum, not midat Yisrael. The Gemara will describe or discuss exactly what this means in the Mishnah. But you can act on behalf of a nachri, but you have to be careful here that you are really lending out the money of the nachri and earning interest for the nachri. And it's not that the Jew is really earning interest and he's just claiming it belongs to the nachri. That's the basic idea of what the Mishnah is suggesting. The Gemara will get into the details of that. Gemara says, Lememra de Bershuta de Mekabel Kaima. The Mishnah basically says that it is in the hands of the recipient. The fact that the Mishnah calls it over here, Rashi adds in the words, Stam Sona Barzel, this structure of a Sona Barzel makes it that it is in the responsibility of the party who is receiving the item. That means that the structure is that the person gives him some sort of capital or gives him some sort of item to use, and he's fully responsible for it. Okay, so he's fully responsible for it. Just because he's fully responsible for it doesn't mean that it's in his possession. What you're suggesting here in the nature of the way the Mishnah describes it is that it is in his possession, and the fact that it is in his possession makes it that there's a problem of interest. Because that means that he's borrowing the item, forced to return the item at its original value, plus you're going to pay him some sort of fee, or you're going to pay him some sort of return on his investment, then you have interest because you held possession of the item. Now, if you hold possession of the item, that has nafkaminot in other places in halacha, which is, that's what the Gemara asks. Vireminu, is that really true? Hamekabel tzona barzel min anachrim, vladot p'turim min amechora. If you accept from a non-Jew tzona barzel, that means that the capital or the asset belonged to the non-Jew. He's depositing it with you. And when he deposited with you, he forced you to guarantee not only that you're going to return the item, but you're going to return the value of that item. That's Soner Barzel. But in addition to that, you're going to now bring up these animals. If they sell for a higher profit, you guys will share the profit. If they have children, the babies will belong to both of you. So there is a return here. Now, with regards to the mitzvah of Bechorah, a Jew is required to give the firstborn of his behemot to Horot, to the Kohen. And that is true also of a chamor, but that has its own rules. That requirement is only when it is a Jew who owns the animal. If the Jew owns the animal jointly with the nachri, there's no requirement to give the bechorah to the kohen. That's learned out of the psukim in the Gemara and Bechorot, that has to be the sole proprietorship of the Jew in order to be chayav in bechorah. What the braita in Bechorot is saying is that a person who accepts sona barzamin and achrim, Vladot p'turim min ha-bechorah. The children born are p'turim min ha-bechorah. Now, as far as the mothers are concerned, or the first line of animals that were given from the Nachri to the Jew, it's clear there that they're p'turim min ha-bechorah because it's the Nachri's animals that he's giving to you to work. The problem is now in the next generation. Once those animals give birth to the babies are split between the Nachri and the Jews caring for these animals. Yet, it says, p'turim in ha-bechorah. They are not chayav in bechorah, which indicates that the nachri still has ownership in those animals. Even the babies, the achri still has ownership. Even though you're going to split it 50-50, he has ownership in these animals. That goes against our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that the animals are in your possession. Since they're in your possession, it's a loan to you. And then when you provide returns on that, that's ribit. If it never was in your possession, it was still in the possession of the original owner, the provider of the capital, the provider of the animals, then it wouldn't be ribit, because it's still his animal. And if his animal earns returns, that's not a problem, because it's his. The reason it's problematic here is because when he gives it to the person who's providing the services, or the person who's going to invest it, he's given it over to him as a loan. Once it's given to the other party, it's not the original owner's animal, and that's why there's a problem of ribit. Yet the Gemara in Bechorah says the Nachri still has ownership in these animals, and that's what prevents them from being chayav in Bechorah. So Rabbi Elokasha, had mekabalei unsa v'zola, had lo kabalei unsa v'zola. The difference is, what type of responsibility did he accept? In our mission over here, he accepted the responsibility for unsa v'zola, both if something happens to the animal, as well as if the animal goes down in price and value. He accepted both problems. Therefore, it becomes a full-fledged loan because he's guaranteeing basically the principal back. He's guaranteeing the value of the animal. He says, if anything happens to the animal, plus if it goes down in value, I'm guaranteeing that I'll pay it back to you. The Brayta Bechorot's a case where the Jew did not accept Unsav Vezula upon himself. The problem with that is, Amalei Rava, Ikabalei Mara Unsav Vezula Son of Barzel Karidlei? Wait a minute. If the original owner accepts the responsibility of something happening to the animal or the depreciation in value of the animal, then you call that Son of Barzel. The whole point of Son of Barzel is you've shifted all the risk to the individual who is investing it, who is the recipient of the capital. If the original owner keeps that risk, that's no longer called Son of Barzel. So how can you say the Mishnah in Bechorot is talking about a case where the Nachri is giving it to him and he's keeping all the responsibilities? That's not called Son of Barzel. Va'od. In addition to that, Adatani Seifa V'amekablim Son of Barzel Menakum, our Mishnah, instead of saying in the latter half of the Mishnah that a Jew may not do this, but you can do this with a non-Jew, Liflog V'litnei B'didei, make a finer distinction within our Mishnah itself. That's only in the case where the original owner didn't accept the responsibility for something happening to the animal or depreciation in its value. Aval, but Kabil Mara Unsa Bezola Shapir Dami, had in our Mishnah the original owner kept the responsibility for any losses to the animals or any diminution in market value, that would have been totally fine. That transaction is not a loan anymore, and therefore it would have been mutar. So why do you have to go to a Nachri? Jews can structure a situation like that. So that can't be the way to explain the Mishnah here and the Mishnah in Bechorot. El Amarova, Idi V'idi Delo Kabila Mara Unz Vezula. It's clear here that the original owner accepts no responsibility whatsoever. The recipient of the capital of the animals is fully responsible for anything that happens to the animals or any market depreciation. And that's obviously the problem in our Mishnah. That's not permissible with a Jew, but it is permissible with an Achri. V'gabi Bechorot. So then why are you patur from Bechora? What type of ownership does an Achri have here? V'ainu tam, t'vladot, turim in a Bechora. This is the reason why they are patur, even the offspring, which are going to be split 50-50 between the Yisrael and Achri. Why is it that the Yisrael's chelek or portion is patur from the Bechora? Kevan, de'ilo yayiv zuzei. If he doesn't pay back the Nachri, the loan here is the value of the animals that he gave him. It's not even just the animals. He has to pay him back the value of the animals at the time that he gave it to him. If he doesn't pay him back, ata Nachri, tafisle the behema. The Nachri will come and confiscate the animals as collateral. Vilo mishkach la behema, if he doesn't find the original animals that he gave him, tafisle the vladot, and he's going to go after the children that were born. Vahavile yad Nachri be'emtza. And therefore, it's deemed to be what's called, it's an expression that's used in the Gemara in Bechorot, which is Yad Nachri Be'emtza. As long as the Nachri has some say or ownership here, he blocks it or he makes it that it's not necessary anymore to give the Bechora to the Kohen. Chol Yad Nachri Be'emtza, patur min ha-Bechora. Anytime a Nachri is involved, you're automatically patur from the Bechora. So the patur here is not because the Nachri really has ownership. It's the fact that his ownership is through the collateralization of these items towards the repayment of the Tzon of Barzel. And in Bechora, that's sufficient. By Bechora, that fact that he has a right of collateral, a right of confiscation, is enough to make you patur min Bechora. But as far as Rebit is concerned, that right of confiscation doesn't make it that it's not yours. It doesn't make it that you're not fully responsible for it, and it's Rebit, because you are fully responsible as if it was lent to you, and you have to repay that value, and therefore it's deemed to be Rebit as far as the din of interest is concerned. The Baalei Tosafot over here note that it's interesting that the Gemara in Psachim, when it talks about taxation, and over there the Gemara says that Behemat Arnona is Chayevet in Bechora. The animal that is subject to tax payments to the government is still chayevet in Bechora. So according to there are two lishanot in Rava over there in the Gemara in Pesachim. It says, lishna kam in the Rava, heichet amatz Yisrael l'slukei bezuze. Because the Jew doesn't have to pay the arnona through the animal, he can pay him off with cash. And since he can pay him off with cash, and then the government won't confiscate the animal, it makes it his. He says that's just the opposite of what we just said here. Over there you're saying that the arnona has a right of confiscation, but since the Jew can pay him off and protect against the confiscation, it's considered to be the Jew's. Over here you're saying that, since if the Jew defaults and doesn't pay the cash, the Nachri can confiscate it, then it's patur b'bechora. So take your pick, which one is it? So Yesh Lamar, the halt amikar shel beima shel Yisrael mitchila. Says the difference is, over there, The animal itself really belongs to the Jew. Ela demishubedet l'arnona. It's just encumbered to the payment of the taxes. So the truth is, it really belongs to the Jew. The government has a right to come in and confiscate it if you don't pay the taxes. But the primary, I would say, situation is you pay your taxes and you keep the animal because it's your animal. You default on your taxes, we're going to come after the animal. Over there, we don't consider that to be Yad Nachri B'Emsa. Over here, that's not the case. The animals were originally belonged to the Nachri. And as long as you don't pay or return them to the Nachri, they really are the Nachri's animals. And so therefore, his right of confiscation here is stronger because his right of ownership or his imprint on these animals is much stronger. The default situation is that they're his animals. You don't want him to take the animals back, pay him the cash that you owe him, and then you get to keep the animals. So because of the default situation, it makes it different. That the Yad Nachri B'Emsa here protects you, exempts you from having to pay Bechorah because his ownership is much stronger. In the case of the Arnona, it's the other way around. Your ownership is stronger. The right of confiscation is just if you default on the payment of the cash. But otherwise, the default is it's your animal. Over here, the default is it's the Nachri's animal until you pay him to make sure that he doesn't take the animal back. And that creates the difference over here. All right, so now the Gemara is going to move into a more gadic side of Rebit. We're going to start with it today with a discrete piece of this, which is interesting, Rebit to a Nachri. The Gemara here quotes a pasuk from Mishlei, which says, Marbe hono b'neshech v'tarbit, one who increases his wealth through the charging of interest, l'chonein dalim yikbitzenu. The one who takes care of the poor will gather it in. Now, the Pashtu, the Pasuk, is that Chonein Dalim is a reference to God. We use that in the Slichot. We use that in our Tfilot. Kol Hashem Chonein Dalim, the one who provides for the poor or the impoverished, the one who favors or takes care of the impoverished, Yikpitzenu, God will get it back. So a person who's making his wealth through the charging of interest, Hashem will gather that in and distribute it to those that are impoverished and those that are poor. Almost, in a sense, he's going to even out the score, because the one who's collecting the interest is usually taking it from those that are poor, and he's preying on those that are poor. Hashem will take back that interest and redistribute it to those that are poor. The Gemara will tell us later on that those that are involved in taking interest where it's improper, they will lose all of their assets. I mean, that it's a way that eats away at your assets, and you'll lose everything. So the idea being that you'll lose everything, and it'll be redistributed to those that you took it from. Ma'ilo chonein dalim. Who is the Chonein Dalim over here? The Gemara's answer is very interesting, because again, the Pashtun of Pasuk is it's time at Hashem. Amar Rav Kagon Shavur Malka. The king of Persia at the time, a non-Jewish king, Shavur Malka. So Shavur Malka over here was confiscating or taking away property or monies from these individuals, and then redistributing it to the poor. The Robin Hood scenario, redistribution of wealth. Shavur Malka, Melech Parasaya, Rashi says, he was the king of Persia. And then he ran and redistributed it to the non-Jewish poor. Why are they called Dalim? Because they don't have the mitzvot. But the key element here is that he's redistributing it to the non-Jewish poor. Had he redistributed it to the Jewish poor, at least the mitzvot would be done with the money that he's confiscating from the Jews. On the other hand, what's happening here is he's confiscating the money from them and then distributing it to the non-Jewish poor, so you're not even getting a mitzvah with the money that was taken away from them. But the Gemara here sees in that, someone who is making his wealth through the charging of interest, it will be taken away. Whether that Chonein Dalim is Hashem who takes it away, or whether that's the government who comes in and confiscates the property and redistributes it. So now, the pasuk itself is not a chiddush. You're not allowed to charge interest. You do it illegally, and you go against the word of the Torah, it will be taken away from you. That's not a surprise. Here is the surprise part of this. It's even from interest that you charge to non-Jews. So now the Gemara here is saying the Pasuk in Mishlei says that it's not only problematic to charge interest to Jews, it's problematic to charge interest to non-Jews. And you charge interest to non-Jews, it's going to be taken away from you. It's going to be confiscated from you. Oh my goodness, wait a minute. You have a pasuk in the Torah that says otherwise. You have a Mishnah here that says otherwise. Those are the, right away. Eitvei Rova, the Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman's Talmid Rova asked him right away. Ula Nachri Tashich. It is a explicit pasuk in the Torah, which I read to you before. Ula Nachri Tashich. Ula Achicha Lo Tashich. that you should lend to the Nachri with interest. Again, I said before, the Rambam was at extreme position that it's a mitzvah to say to lend to Nachri with interest. How could it be here that you're saying that you're going to be penalized for charging interest to the Nachri? My tashich, lav tashuch. Isn't it when it says there, lachri tashich? Doesn't it mean you should take interest from him? You should bite him? Biting him means that you will take interest away from him. It says, lo tashich. No, it means that you can pay him interest. That means that you can be bidden. So that is lachri tashich, is that you be bidden by the Nachri or you pay interest to the Nachri. So Rav Nachman is suggesting the pasuk means not that you have a right to take interest from the Nachri, but you can pay interest to the Nachri. Now the problem is, lo sagi de lav hachi. So Rashi explains over here, wait a minute, the Torah is coming to command you that you must pay interest to the Nachri? I mean, that's what it's saying, le Nachri tashich, that's a tzivoy. Pay interest to the Nachri. What do you mean? So it's not enough that if you don't pay, it's one of the mitzvot now, you must pay the Nachri interest? That's what it sounds like from the pasuk. And then what he's explaining, he says, lo sagi de lav hachi, without that, it would not be sufficient. That v'chi ba katub l'tzavot olein l'itein ribit lakum? Dilo latir kamar. If you're telling me it's mutar, pshita, hechitei delay the mitzray. It's a chiddush that you're not allowed to charge interest. So if you said nothing, we would assume you could pay interest to the Nachri. Now the Torah comes and commands you to pay interest to the Nachri? Why is that necessary? Why do you have to do that? So Gemara says, no, lafuke achicha dolo. It comes to tell you that by you pay interest to the Nachri, but not to your brother, not to a Jew. Gemara says, achicha v'edja katav ve. That's the next line in the pasuk. The Nachri tashich, ulachicha lo tashich. What do you need to make an inference from this? Avor ala baseh v'lo taseh. Coming to teach you that there are two violations. When you pay interest to your brother, to Israel, there are two violations. There is a lo taseh, which is achicha lo tashich, and there's a mitzvah taseh, which is le Nachri tashich. Pay interest to the Nachri, but don't pay it to your brother. And we know kol lota said that derives from an assay. An inference from an assay is considered to be an assay. And therefore you violated both an assay and a lota say in paying interest to your brother. So it's a very interesting change in the pashtuta pasuk. Pashtuta pasuk is that you may charge interest to a Nachri, number one. Number two is you can pay Nachri interest, but it should have nothing to do with achicha. Yet here, the Chazal changed the whole thing over and make it that the explanation is that you should be paying interest to an achri, not to your brother, and that there is no right to collect interest from an achri. Okay, now you solve the pasuk problem. What about our Mishnah? Lavin mehen o malvin otam beribit. You can borrow from them and lend to them with interest. V'chein begir toshav. Seems explicit in the Mishnah that lending money to a goy with interest is totally fine. Zam Rav Chia, brave the Rav Huna, lo nitzrecha, ela b'kdei chayav, for your livelihood. In that you're allowed to do it where it is absolutely necessary for you to make a living. That's what Rashi says, etirulov, yoter mikan asur midrabanan, dilma ati de misrach. In excess of your livelihood or your necessities, that you're not allowed to do because you might start to follow after the Nachri, you might become close with the Nachri, and follow his ways. Ravinamar, hocha b'talmidei chachamim askinan. So here we're dealing with talmidei chachamim. Time am I gazur rabbanon. Why were the rabbanon gazur that you shouldn't charge interest to a Nachri? Shema yomold mimasav. Maybe you'll learn from his ways. V'kev into talmid chacham hu, lo yomold mimasav. Since he is a talmid chacham, you won't learn from his ways. So now, what he's saying is that this heter is not only kedei chayav, where it is your livelihood, it's also a heter for talmidei chachamim who are not going to be captured by the Nachri or following the ways of the Nachri and think it's okay to charge interest to Jews as well. He's not going to be captured by that, and therefore it'd be permissible because the Isur d'Rabbanan would not apply to him. I'm assuming that Ravina is trying to get a heter for the talmidei chachamim, because for them, it's a way for them to provide for their livelihood. I mean, it was a way for them to make money without having to invest a lot of time. And therefore, that would provide them with the means by which to continue learning. So he's looking for that dispensation and saying that maybe Talmidei Chachamim is the equivalent of Kedei Chayav, even though maybe it exceeds Kedei Chayav, but it's a way for them to maintain their lifestyle as Talmidei Chachamim without being violation of the Issur d'Rabbanan, which is all about protecting you from becoming close to the Nachri, which the Talmid Chacham wouldn't otherwise do. So what is interesting that happens here is now, you have a structure in which the Chachamim come along and undermine what otherwise is written in the Torah. What seems to be explicit in the Torah, that you should lend to the Nachri with interest, the Chachamim come along and say you should not lend to the Nachri in interest. Now that's very difficult. Why are the Chachamim coming here to be oker davar min haTorah? Especially in a situation in which it's not just an inference from the Torah, it's a situation in which an explicit pasuk in the Torah, and the Chachamim are coming and saying, no problem, we don't think that that is correct, and this is the right interpretation. So part of that is that they are relying on the pasuk in Mishle, that the pasuk in Mishle already indicates that there is some sort of gzeirah or taknat chachamim that says it's not all good to be charging interest. And so therefore the gzeirah, the taknat, is a much earlier one, maybe even from the time of Shlomo HaMelech, that this taknat is in place. But that now presents a problem, especially for the Jews in Europe in the Middle Ages, which is that the only business that the Jews are allowed in the Middle Ages to engage in was that of lending money, because the church had usury laws, and those laws prevented the non-Jews from entering into the money lending business. Therefore, the Jews became the default money lenders in these situations. But here you see that not only is it neutral to lend money to Nachri, here there's an Isur Derabanan. An Isur Derabanan that will result in you losing all of your money if you lend to them with interest. How do you circumvent that problem or avoid that Isur? And Balei HaTosafot are faced with that. And the Balei HaTosafot are first dealing with the fact that how is it that the Chachamim are going against the Din HaTorah? And again, they said what I indicated, that they're relying on that pasuk for Mishnah. Uma shenaguata la'avot enachrim. Tosafot recognizes the reality that Jews are lending money to non-Jews all the time now. Omer Rabbeinu Tam mishum debishol sufrim halech achar ha'mekel. That when it comes to Dinei Derabanan, we paskin like the most cooler opinion. V'kaimalan ki idach lishna, tematne hadrav Huna, abraita de Rav Yosef. And we're going to hold like this statement of Rav Huna is really connected to another braita of Rav Yosef. V'lo asumi olam Rav Nachum Rav Huna ribit dinachri. And therefore, in the second lashon, which we're going to do tomorrow, there was never a restriction against lending money to an achri with interest, meaning based on the two lashonot. The first Lashon over here says it's Asur. The second Lashon, which we'll do tomorrow, we'll see that there's an alternate view of where Rav Huna's statement was said. In that alternate view, there is no restriction Derabanan. So Rabbeinu Tam says it's a Din Derabanan. Din Derabanan, we go the Kula. So the Kula is that we'll take the second Lashon and say that that is the normative way to view it, and it's okay to charge interest to a non-Jew. And then he says, Vafilu Lishna Kama. Even according to the first Lashon that says it's Asur, Yesh Latir, we are subject to heavy taxation by the kings and the princes or the governors. I mean, there was also a church tax that was imposed on non-believers. And so, v'alkol havi kedei chayenu. And therefore, our mere survival depends on the fact that we can lend money. It's our only means of parnasa. It's our only means of paying for the taxes that are levied against our community. And the heavy taxation, the only way for it to deal with it is actually to lend money in order to garner interest and pay it. Va'od, shanu shuim ben ha'umot. We live amongst the non-Jews. V'yav shalanu lihistaker b'shum davar im lo nisab nitani mehem. And what are we going to make money from if we don't do business with them? There's not sufficient or self-sufficient means to make parnosa just from the Jewish community. We must interact with the non-Jews around us. And the only means we have is through this lending of money and charging interest. It's become an absolute necessity for us to make money through charging interest. So it's just very interesting historiographical insight into what was going on in their time, which is that they are really in a bind where they know there's a Zisur Derabanan, but they also know that this is their only means of making money. And they're left in a position where if they don't do this, they're really going to have trouble paying the taxes levied against the community. They also will not have means by which to make parnasa if they don't interact with the non-Jews. And for all these reasons, Rabbeinu Tam is saying it's absolutely necessary. Now again, it does put them in a bind. And the situation that the Jews were the money lenders always put them in an awkward position, because anytime anybody was dissatisfied or had a problem, it was usually taken out on the Jews, because they were seen as the money lenders causing the problems, the ones that were taking away from those that were impoverished, and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, there are many stories of those unfortunate events. But then Tosfa goes on to say, yes, from the Perek in Yechezkel that describes Tchiyat HaMeitim, and one of the people that are left behind or do not come back to life is the one who charged interest. So there you see that maybe that a goy is subject to the restriction of interest. Otherwise, why didn't he get up? Why isn't he part of Tchiyat HaMeitim? V'yishlamar, the Shema B'nei Noach hayu muzarim ala ribit, kamo shuzaru ala gezel. Says maybe B'nei Noach are commanded not to charge interest, just like they are charged not to steal from each other. This goes to a machloket, the Ramban and the Rambam, with regards to what is the mitzvah of dinim for Bnei Noach. This mitzvah of dinim, the way the Rambam reads it, is to set up a court system. The way the Ramban sends it is that you have to set up a civil code that involves the mitzvot of proper civil conduct and adjudication between parties. And so you could read the Ramban. If you read him, he's found in Parshat Vayishlach. In the case of Dinah and Shechem, there the Ramban comments in it, and it almost seems like for the Ramban that the Bnei Noach have to keep the mitzvot of Choshen Mishpat. They basically have to set up a structure of Shulchan Aruch of Choshen Mishpat, and they're subject to the same laws. If that is the case, Tosaf Barovir speculates, maybe just like they're Chayav in Gezel, they're also Chayav in Ribit. Even though Ribit is not a derivative of Gezel, but rather a separate mitzvah completely, maybe they're subject to it. And maybe that means Ulachri Tashich in the Torah, maybe that's the meaning of the Pasuk. It says over there, Jews may not charge interest to Jews. Non-Jews also may not charge interest to non-Jews because they're subject to the rules of Bnei Noach. And that's Yim Tamar, Yim Kein, Mai Parach Tashich Lo Sagi, Delo Tashich, Dilma At Lememar, Afagadu Zuru Al Ribit Zemizeh. Even though they're restricted from charging interest to each other, Shari Le La'akum La'avot Yisrael B'Yibit. They're not restricted from lending a Jew with interest. Because if it was problematic, the Jew couldn't do it and pay interest because then it would be a problem with Lifnei Iver. So that would teach you then that a Nachri might be subject to the same restriction as a Jew. The fact that you're not allowed to charge your brother interest, that shows you that to lend to a Goy is Mutar. And so we wouldn't need the Pasuk of Ulanachri Tashich, but Tosfot speculates here that maybe non-Jews are not allowed to charge each other interest because that's one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. In the end, Tosfot rejects it and says, V'yish lomar, the B'nei Noach lo azuru min haribit. Then he asks from the Perek in Yechezkel that describes Tchiyat HaMeitim, and one of the people that are left behind or do not come back to life is the one who charged interest. So there you see that maybe that a goy is subject to the restriction of interest. Otherwise, why didn't he get up? Why isn't he part of Tchiyat HaMeitim? So he says, maybe, afo pishno nitztavu, kamo shekaimu avotenu et haTorah, afo pishno etan lehem. He says, maybe, even though they're not commanded directly not to charge interest, maybe it's something that they should be keeping, or it's the right thing to do. Not that it's an isur for them to charge interest, but charging interest is just not being a nice person. And again, this goes back to what we spoke about before, that the concept of charging interest in the Torah is usually a usurious loan to someone who's completely impoverished and is looking for their basic necessities. And therefore, you're taking advantage of someone in a very difficult situation. And that type of person, maybe they're not in violation of a restriction, but they're still, that's not a nice thing to do. That's not a proper way to behave towards other people. And that's why there's no Tchiyat HaMeitim for that individual. Not because he's not keeping the laws, but this is a law that's worth keeping, even if you're not nitztaveh in it. So here the Balei Tosfot deal with two very interesting topics. Number one is there restriction of ribit for the non-Jew? Number two is, even though there is a Rabbanan restriction against us charging interest to the Nachri, we need to find ways to get around that or permissibility for that, because otherwise we have no livelihood, we have no ways of making ends meet. And therefore, Rabbeinu Tam is very makil here to say that one may charge interest to a Nachri in order to gain their livelihood. All right, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Ayin Aleph from Aleph.